And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where you may remember we asked whether the LHC, that's the Large Hadron Collider, could really make antimatter which might be stolen by Dan Brown's villains in Angels and Demons to blow up the Pope. And we decided probably not. This is the kind of thing Sean Carroll deals with. You see, physicists these days are so very versatile, they run law colleges in Oxford and even advise movie producers like Steven Spielberg.
Well, if you're a scientist and you live in Los Angeles, pretty soon you're going to be starting talking to movie people, because these days movies and TV have a lot of science in them. And we would like science to be represented a little bit more accurately in the movies, and the movie people would like a little bit more realism and a little better ideas in their films.
And what do you think of the overall results so far with the Dan Browns and the 2012s and so on?
Well, movies are always going to be about selling tickets and providing entertainment, and so it's not going to be a science documentary. We think that it's possible to get the science right and nevertheless still have an entertaining movie and have a lot of fun. So Dan Brown doesn't quite succeed at doing that, but it is possible to have it happen.
We had Frank Close on The Science Show a few weeks ago talking about the antimatter being stolen from the Large Hadron Collider and used to blow up the Vatican, various other things like that. Now, that of course, is just sheer whimsy and rather good fun. Are there ways in which you've had science effectively put into a film, a feature film, that have impressed you?
Actually, several times. For example, Iron Man, I think, is a great movie about science. Now, it is not true that a guy who's in a cave can take scrap metal and build a suit that he can fly around in. But that's okay. The scientists don't mind if you stretch what can be done. What they care about is the process. They care that there's some realistic understanding of how science works. And in Iron Man, Tony Stark, trying to build his suit, acts as a scientist. The whole second act of the movie is a laboratory, and he's doing trial and error. He's seeing what works. He's being surprised by the results. And that's really how science happens. So if there's more stuff like that, scientists would be very pleased.
His funding is very convenient. Of course, he's a billionaire, isn't he?
That does help. And we would all like to have a billionaire that would help us along, but we can't all have it.
But directly, what is your involvement?
Well, my wife, Jennifer Ouellette, is the head of a new program from the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. called the Science and Entertainment Exchange. So for the first time, there's a formal system where if you're a director, a producer, or a screenwriter, you can call up Jennifer and you can say, I need a scientist. You know, I need to know about wormholes, or I need to know about antimatter. And she will find you the world's expert in science in that, and they will get together. And she finds a kind of scientist who is willing to be helpful, not just willing to be a copy editor and scold you about your mistakes.
Or give you about 200 kilos of notes that take about 10 years to read or something like that.
That's right. It has to be about entertainment. It has to be about getting interesting things on the screen. And that can happen without compromising the science too much.
Meanwhile, your own research on time, the trouble with that kind of area for people who are not physicists is that an awful lot of it seems incomprehensible. Not because for the maths, but because it's so paradoxical, it's so strange, it's so as if the world down there amongst the atoms is totally different and we've just got to take it on trust. Is it like that?
Well, I don't think it's like that, because I think that time is one of those subjects which connects both our everyday experience, you know, we move through time, we wear wristwatches, and the universe. I mean, the universe feels that time passes in a certain way. The early universe is different than the later universe. And the wonderful thing is that these things are connected. The fact that in our kitchens we can make an omelet out of eggs, but we can't make eggs out of an omelet, is ultimately because of what was going on at the Big Bang. It's ultimately because of the wider universe that we're connected in. So things that happen to us and we experience in our everyday lives are really part of a much bigger picture.
Yes, but you actually do talk in physics of material that does go back, you know, the tachyon is supposed to be a particle that goes backwards in time, as we can't. Is that right?
Well, that would be right, but tachyons don't exist. So they're a hypothetical.
That's a hitch.
That is a hitch. So we actually have a pretty good understanding of how time works at the microscopic level. So when you have individual atoms, we know how time works. Or in your everyday lives, if you have billiard balls and you ignore friction, we know how time works. The mysteries come when things get complicated, when you have eggs, or when you have human beings, or when you have love affairs, or you have evolution of species. Then there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of change over time, and we're trying to connect what goes on at these very small scales where we do know what's going on to these very large scales that we experience around us.
So are you saying that in human experience, everything that counts for us, we cannot reverse time effectively.
That's exactly right. There's what scientists call the arrow of time. It points from the past to the future. We never think that we'll fly in some spaceship to a different star system and find a civilization that is constantly turning omelets into eggs. We think that the whole observable universe feels the same direction of time.
So where did the tachyon come from as a concept?
Well, it turns out that the particles that we know about, the particles that we have discovered in our laboratories, all always move more slowly than the speed of light, or at the speed of light if they're light itself. So it's natural to ask, what would it be like if you had particles that moved faster than the speed of light? And these are what tachyons would be if they existed. And it turns out that you get interesting effects, like tachyons, if they can move faster than the speed of light, would always have to move faster than the speed of light. They could never move more slowly, and they could, in fact, travel backwards in time. So that's probably one of the reasons they don't exist, because then you could send signals to yourself in the past and say, don't go on that date when you're at your senior prom. Yeah.
How are you dealing with this in your own research at Caltech?
Well, I'm trying to understand what the early universe was like. We think that it was conditions near the Big Bang that set up the universe for this arrow of time that gets reflected in our kitchens today. But we don't know why it was like that. We don't know why the early universe was in a particular kind of arrangement where it was very orderly, the entropy was low, and it was waiting for all this wonderful stuff around us to happen. So I'm trying to understand the Big Bang and even what happened before the Big Bang.
Getting anywhere?
A little bit, yes. We're getting there slowly. It's hard because when you start talking about what happened before the Big Bang, you can't see it. You have no direct experience. But what you can do by thinking about the nature of time is you can say, okay, that scenario doesn't make sense. It doesn't answer these fundamental questions that you're just putting things in ad hoc by hand. So you need to sort of be focused on what kinds of scenarios would naturally lead you to the kind of Big Bang we actually see.
Okay, having reached that point, is there any conflict between what you're finding out and some of your colleagues in the same sort of field? Because, you know, for example, on the Science Show a few weeks ago, I talked to Alan Guth, and I said, well, what was there before and how did it decide to start when it wasn't there? And he said, a quantum fluctuation. I said, well, none of us know what that is.
Well, I am. I think, you know, quantum fluctuations are the last refuge of a scoundrel when it comes to the universe.
I wondered about that.
So, in fact, my favorite idea is that there was something before the Big Bang. If there's really nothing before the Big Bang, again, we don't know. We're speculating right now and trying to make sense of it. So it's very possible either the Big Bang was the beginning or there was something before. To me, having something before the Big Bang makes more sense. Then you can say, okay, here's why the Big Bang happened. It was set up in a particular way by what happened before. If it really was just the beginning, then you have to sort of say, well, that's the end of explanation. That's just the way things are. To me, that's a little bit less satisfying.
Is there anything comprehensible you can tell me about what there was before?
There is. In fact, I think that my favorite theory of what there was before the Big Bang was there was another universe, a parent universe, and we are the baby universe of the parent. And the parent universe was just empty space. There was nothing there. It was just sitting there sort of quietly. And then there was a quantum fluctuation, which, you know, is the answer for everything. But the point is that even empty space can't be completely quiet. It cannot be completely stable and just sit there forever. That is one of the lessons of modern physics. So my idea is that empty space was sitting there forever, and then now and again in that empty space, there's a little event that happens that bubbles off a new baby universe, and that we live in one of those baby universes.
As you're already implying, there are lots of universes, or more than one universe. Could there be one where the rules are simply different, where time does go backwards?
Well, yes. In fact, there could be a lot of universes. The conditions in those universes could be different. And about time going backwards, it could be that compared to us, time goes backwards in some other universe, but compared to them, they would say that we are going backwards. There would never be a universe where people experienced time in some weird way. There would never be any Benjamin Button scenario where people got younger as they aged. In every local patch of the universe, people would experience time consistently.
Professor Sean Carroll, who lectured on time at the University of Sydney this week. His book about that is From Eternity to Here. He's at Caltech, where staff and students must have 300-point IQs.